Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of July 23rd, 2019. Robert Caslin was elected the new president of the University of South Carolina. His selection came after Governor Henry McMaster recently pushed board members to reconsider voting on him following a bruising selection process in April that spawned protests from students at the state's biggest university. Those protests returned this month with a no-confidence vote from faculty, complaints from donors and alumni over someone they see as unqualified to lead the school due to his lack of a doctorate degree, and controversial comments over binge drinking and sexual assault. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who are at the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections. Instead of getting amped up for Mueller testifying this week in Congress, get ready for some short answers and really nothing new, folks. I hate to ruin the surprise for you. Or as we all unify in hatred against the new Cats movie. Yeah, have you seen that trailer? Did anyone ask for this? That's where you need to build the wall, folks. Whew! And with that, let's get to quorum call. Meow! Meow! Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here in the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, a Washington Post analysis of newly released federal drug enforcement data shows Charleston County has distributed the highest concentration of prescription opioids of any county in the nation. However, as the Post and Courier reports, that is due to the county being home to the Veteran Affairs North Charleston Consolidated Mail Outpatient Pharmacy, which shipped an increasing number of opioids to veterans between 2006 and 2012. Now, that newly released DEA data is several years old and only includes data for hydrocodone and oxycodone, the two most commonly prescribed painkillers. Number two, the state newspaper reports that South Carolina led the nation with 6 children dying in hot cars last year. This year, 21 children have died in hot cars, including one in South Carolina. Richland County Coroner Gary Watts says a child's body can heat up to 3 to 5 times faster than adults. Erin Hawley, a parent from James Island who almost left her 4-week-old child in a hot car, testified in front of Congress in May for the Hot Cars Act of 2019. The act would require all new cars to be equipped with an alert system to prevent children from being left behind. Number three, the Greenville News reports that U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos recently visited Taylor's to promote a new federal school choice program that would subsidize private or homeschool education for more students. Governor Henry McMaster, State Superintendent of Education Molly Spearman, and local educators joined DeVos at a private K-12 school for special needs students to promote the new program. If passed, the program would create scholarships funded by tax credits for individuals and businesses. And number four, the Greenville News reports that BMW will freeze pensions for U.S. workers. All current employees, including those at the Spartanburg plant, will now pay into a 401k-like retirement income account. BMW says removing the guaranteed pension payments will reduce the company's strategic risk, and the move comes after BMW says profits could fall to as low as 6% this year, a sharp drop from last year's 10%. The company had already stopped offering pensions to new hires in 2012. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Each week we give you a headline, a little taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. Headline: Florida Man Carjacker Arrested Because He Can't Drive Stick. And just like that guy's transmission stalling out, we bury the lead. Last October, Harris Pasides announced that after 10 years as USC's president that he was going to retire in 2019. This led to a search committee being formed and the use of an executive recruitment firm to find 4 candidates for the spot, one of whom was former General Robert Caslin, formerly superintendent of West Point. The board was set to go forward with Caslin's election in April, but student protests over the lack of diversity among candidates, controversial remarks Caslin made about sexual assault, and his lack of a doctorate degree pushed the Board of Trustees to continue searching. The lid blew off the search earlier this month when Governor Henry McMaster, who serves as the ex officio chair of the USC Board of Trustees, began pushing members to reconsider Caslin, someone he saw as a strong candidate for the school. Following an outcry from students, faculty, donors, and alumni, in an improperly called meeting, the board officially elected Caslin, the 29th president of the university, in an 11-8-1 board vote last Friday. Andy Shane, the Post and Courier's Columbia bureau chief, has been on top of this situation, and he's back to lay it all out with us, along with Russ McKinney from South Carolina Public Radio. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Andy, it's been a whirlwind couple days.
I'll just say, just listening to you describe all of that at the beginning,
I was
waiting for another verse to the chapter of the book. I mean, it has been, people have just said unprecedented in the state. I mean, just the idea that, let alone there's just this discord on campus over the president, but the fact that Governor McMaster had to get involved in this in order to get it going. And then when it got going, you know, you just sort of all saw all the fissures that were in place about him. I think a lot of folks had thought he had gone away. He wasn't coming back. They were going to restart the search. It was interesting that he did that in May. I spoke to some trustees and they said, well, as far as we're concerned, he's still a candidate. But again, even from May until July, nothing happened. So we again were thinking, all right, well, maybe pretty soon they'll start the search committee again, employ a search firm and go through the whole process again. And again, here we are on today. Robert Caslin was introduced formally to the media as the new president of USC.
Mm-hmm. And before we get into all that happened today recently, Russ, Andy, you said unprecedented situation. Can you maybe give us some historical background here, some context onto what this whole search has been like from a historic perspective?
Well, the last three presidents before this one were elected unanimously or by acclamation, and they were consensus candidates. I mean, this was he mentioned a fissure. This is a fissure on the board split like that. That's very, I've never seen anything like that. And, you know, the most important job that the Board of Trustees at any institution, but in this one in particular, has, is to select its leader, to select its president. The president and his or her administration and somewhat faculty run the university day to day. The board approves the budget every year, and they set tuition as part of that. But their main job is to make sure there is a leader in place. They select that leader. And it's incumbent upon them to, one, choose the right person, and two, choose that person the right way. Did they choose the right person? Maybe. Time will tell. Mm-hmm. Did they choose it the right way? There are a lot of folks out there that would say no. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a lot of the objections on the board came from just that, the idea that it wasn't so much they were against Caslin, they were against the process, and whether that was because, as you mentioned, there were no female finalists, or whether it was because actually they felt that they had Caslin and sort of three candidates who they didn't feel like were as the quality that they would expect. Caslin was the only university president among the finalists. And then finally, you know, you sort of had the next step, what happened in July in this month when, you know, McMaster got involved and basically pushed the whole thing along.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into all the ins and outs of that, but I want to start with the most recent activity on this whole situation was we were just at the press conference with the president-elect. Andy, what were some of the takeaways from this press conference? It was about 45 minutes long. He really addressed a lot of things. How did he come across? What were some of the big things that he talked about during that presser?
He knows he has a lot of work to do on that campus. He knows he has to be contrite, that he has to listen, and then I think he's going to have to follow up that listening with action. He's a 43-year Army career guy, three-star general, past five years at West Point. He knows what he's getting into, and in fact, started off by saying, "Don't call me general, call me Bob." And that's a way of trying, I think, to disarm folks a little bit, to tell folks the military thing, while it's a big part of my life, is a part of my past. I need to move forward. I am now a civilian working in a civilian organization. So what I got a sense was here is someone who's at least trying to say, I made some missteps. So the other thing is that he apologized for the remarks that people took the wrong way regarding sexual assault and regarding diversity and said, this is my record. I want you to, don't sort of listen to what I said or misspoke. Look at my record. And he even acknowledged, Jeffrey Collins from the AP asked an excellent question about what did he learn in reading about the comments. He had read all the negative comments about him.
600 pages of comments.
Right, negative comments about him. And he said, you know, I need to be more careful about what I say and how I say it. Which, you know, again, he's got a different audience and he's got to be aware of that.
And he did speak about diversity and wanting to expand it. And he did mention how he did grow that at West Point, too. And he wants to align the demographics of the student body to represent the state more and the faculty as well, saying, you know, we have to have diversity and then have the diversity office report directly to him, too. And he says, if we don't look like the people of South Carolina, we risk appearing illegitimate in their eyes. So he's really going headfirst into the diversity. And then also he was coming out very strong about how he's against sexual assault, how he wants to eradicate sexual assault on college campuses. So really hitting those two points strong, Andy.
He did. He did. And those were the two things he got hit on during this public presentation he made. I've called them kind of Bidenisms. What I meant to say was, you know, kind of moments, you know, again, things if he had said them a little more carefully, I think he wouldn't have been in this situation, but again, found himself there. There's some people arguing, especially his comment about the relationship between binge drinking and sexual assault was taken out of context, that he wasn't really victim shaming. But there's a lot of folks who are already against him because of the other issues you raised. The idea that he doesn't have a PhD. He doesn't have that traditional research background that, again, goes with these university presidents. And he does come from the military, and he was a finalist as Trump's national security advisor. So if you're not exactly in the Trump bandwagon, you might see him in that light as well. You know, on campus, that's one situation. But in reality, when you think about South Carolina as a whole, a place that has one of the largest veteran populations in the nation, that has four major military installations, you know, he's going to be very popular, I think, statewide. And if it's going to mean cutting some things to lower tuition or possibly at least lower the tuition hikes, cut some costs, again, your average South Carolinian probably going to be very happy with that.
Mm-hmm. And Andy, you're just kind of looking at the faculty perspective of this. There was a vote of no confidence by the Faculty Senate about the whole process in Castlin. What does he have to do to work with them? I mean, you mentioned something you're reporting about an email going out to the faculty and the staff about him being the new president. What's the current state of play right now with the faculty and the new president?
He's going to have some ground to make up. I mean, the faculty probably is of the groups on campus, the group that probably is aligned with him the least as a whole. I mean, I think, again, you take your average student, probably fairly aligned with him. You know, you're going to have, you know, factions of students who aren't, but the faculty is really where it's going to matter. I just think he needs to sit, listen to them, say, And what he wants to say, he wants to ask, what are your goals? What do you expect out of this? And get it back. And I think I think they're just concerned about interference. And I think he needs to sit here and assure them that, again, I'm the president. I'm not, you know, I'm going to hire a provost. I'm not going to be someone who's going to be in your life day in and day out, so to speak. But at the same time, you know, again, they wanted someone who reflected their values and their what's important to them, which, again, is that advanced degree. It's that show that you've done research and you've been published and all of that, those kinds of things, just like Harris Pastides, just like John Palms, just like Andrew Sorensen, and so on and onward. So, you know, that's the toughest road he's probably got, but I think he's hitting it head on. He met with faculty this morning, a group of them, and so he just needs to, I think he'll probably continue to do that and to address their concerns.
And kind of looking about this whole process, how do we pinpoint how did this kind of spin back up? I mean, this happened early in July where we started things really moving back, and, you know, we all kind of thought this process was going to continue on for a while. There was an interim president appointed. Kind of walk us back to early July. Was this Governor McMaster kind of coming in here and really using the bully pulpit like we haven't really seen him do recently? I mean, you could say he did it a little bit on the Panthers bill, obviously pushing that, but this was seems like a, you know, reminiscent of Nikki Haley in a sense where he was really just my way or no way, in a sense.
It's interesting in that. That's an interesting comparison. I mean, as we've talked about on this show before, is that the governor doesn't have a lot of power in the state. He or she doesn't draw up the budget. They're not in control of legislation. They handle, 16, 17 state agencies where they appoint directors of 100 and change. This is one of the few times where the governor could flex, in this case, his muscles and do this because the governor is the de facto board chairman at USC. So it's appropriate in a way if he has an opinion about something to sort of share it with his fellow board members. That said, Russ, you've been involved with USC in the past. You ever remember a governor coming to a board meeting?
No.
And so it's very rare. He or she appoints a designee who basically attends the board meeting in their stead. And so apparently at one point, McMaster was thinking about coming to help force a vote to make sure it happened and sort of not just a bully pulpit, but bring the hammer and do that. And so that, yes, it is. And people said, oh, is it about Trump? Is it about, because again, this guy's aligned with Trump. And you know, we have no evidence that Trump has been involved in this at this point. We've asked. I've also worked my sources, the ones that kind of really know, and no. Donald Trump's got bigger fish to fry than worrying about who the president is at USC. Simply put, this was Henry McMaster embarrassed that we had a visitor come to our state and he was treated rudely during April when he came in and everybody protested against him. And all he wanted was a vote for him. Did he want him? Yes. Did he expect them to vote for him? Sure. But if they didn't, at least the man got a vote. Thumbs up, thumbs down. And as you noted, it was 11-8-1. The one was technically someone who was against him. All it would have taken was one vote to go the other way, and we'd be reopening the search for USC's president.
But so then there was all that discussion about the perception that this was political because McMaster was, you know, talking to board members and calling around to board members, which he's, again, part of the board. But then we saw from trustee Charles Williams saying, you know, when the governor called me, it wasn't as a board member but as the governor. So a little bit of a differentiation there. But
it's hard to get rid of the title.
Yeah. I mean, but is that going to be an issue going forward? I mean, there's all this talk about accreditation evaluations because of the potential conflict of politics in this. Is that going to be an issue do we see going forward? Or can the governor kind of say, well, hey, I'm also part of this board. How do you objectively define what's influence and what's politics?
Exactly. And that's the hard part is that, you know, first of all, 16 of the 20 board members are elected by the legislature. You want to talk about political influence? For goodness sake. Even though they represent different judicial circuits across the state, they're elected by the entire legislature. Mm-hmm. So when Hugh Leatherman says something or Jay Lucas, the House Speaker, says something, it kind of matters as much as Henry. In fact, I would even dare say that Hugh Leatherman's support of Kaslan, which came out last week, was even more of a influence than Henry because the governor doesn't elect the board members. He appoints two board members, his designee, and he has one just blanket appointment that he can make. That's 2 of 20. Mm-hmm. As I said, 16 of them come from the state house. What happened real quick is that because of Henry's because of the governor's involvement, the school's accreditors have sent a letter saying, can you please explain to us how this is not undue influence? Essentially, I mean, I'm summarizing and paraphrasing in a way, but that's essentially what the letter said, is help us understand how this isn't violating the rules of outside influence, because what they demand to provide accreditation to the school is that there is no external influence on the school. And that also includes a donor saying, I will not give you another dime unless you make Gavin Jackson the next president of USC. If you don't vote for him, you'll never get another dime from me. So they can't do that. Now, this brings us to Darla Moore, the biggest donor at USC. She said, I don't want Kaslan. She said, I didn't like the process. I think we can do better. But she stopped short of saying, I'm not going to give any more money. She just said, I've got an issue. And she's allowed to express an opinion as long as that opinion doesn't come with a threat. and so that's the line. But and again, with Governor McMaster, what I suspect is going to happen with the accreditors is they're going to ask the legislature to maybe look at changing the law to not make the governor the ex officio board chairman of this one school. He's not the board chairman at Clemson. He's not the board chairman at Lander or mm-hmm. at Coastal Carolina or College of Charleston. It's only at USC.
Russ, when we look at the need to reunify and, you know, 11-8, that is a fissure, like we were saying, is that upon the president-elect to do this? Or how do you work together? In the past, maybe we've seen with governors and presidents working together with the board over controversial issues. What do they have to do at this point to kind of make sure that the university goes forward in a unified manner?
Well, for one thing, I think the entire university community will want Bob Kaslan to succeed. I think you'll find that community rallying around him. The faculty, as Andy mentioned, they may be one of the latter groups. He'll have to prove himself to them and also to the students. His relationship with the board could be kind of tricky. We'll just have to see how that plays out.
You know, Andy, we're looking at Kaslan, and there's, besides all this, you know, the students, the faculty, what are some of the big things that he has to get done? We were talking about hiring a provost, and there's going to be a lot of faculty turnover in the future. What does he need to do to prove himself, I guess, and to make sure that he's doing everything he needs to do?
Here are the openings at USC currently. The chief academic officer, the provost, the chief financial officer, chief development officer, the top fundraiser at the school. And I've been hearing that there's going to be other retirements. I mean, you just have a number of folks, some of whom have just hit their time, and so he could have influence on other parts of the university as well during his tenure. So he's going to be able to shape that administration during his first 5 years. One of the things I would say is he's coming from the outside. He has no affiliation with the university, with the state, with anybody here. I've kind of think that there are no sacred cows.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason I think why he was brought in was just for that, is that Harris Pastides spent 9-10 years at the university before he became president. He'd gone through, he was the head of the public health school and was the VP for research. And so while he had a very successful run, he knew all these folks.
Yeah.
And in the end, Caslin doesn't. And while I think he's going to talk about listening to folks and doing what they think he ought to be doing, also he's got to be looking at the bottom line. I think what the lawmakers want to see is him make some cuts and make some control some costs so that when he comes to them and says, I need something for a big money project, he can say, I've cut X, but give me Y for the new fandangle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's going to be the key. And they also want to see tuition hikes, you know, as low as humanly possible.
Kind of wrapping up, Russ, we did see some activity in the State House towards the end of the session this year about Bill S-798 with Senate President Peeler talking about really reshuffling the USC board. What was the extent of that, and where does it stand? I know there's like actually some pretty good bipartisan support on that bill. What needs to be done, and what likelihood do we see of that happening next year?
Well, in the Senate, there's a bill introduced by the president of the Senate, Harvey Peeler, with Democratic support already. And it was interesting, a meeting to take that bill up for the first time next month was set just minutes after Bob Caslin was elected president. So they're signaling on that. They're clear they have some concerns. They want to take that bill up. But also in the House, the leadership in the House also supports, you know, looking at changing the USC board. Mm-hmm. So I think it's definitely going to be in play next year.
And that's going to change the board from 21 members down to 11, because they're going to switch from the judicial circuits to just the congressional districts plus those other ex officio members too. So a lot to look forward to. Andy, anything else you want to add to this? I think we've covered most of it, but what should we be looking forward to besides maybe that bill in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you want to just sort of see how when his first decisions come through, when he makes his first calls on some things, how folks react, whether they say, whoo, about time you made that change, or wait a minute. He's talked about this whole idea of leading through wandering around, meaning he doesn't want to sit behind his desk and be in his office. And he even said, I'm going to go to Five Points and have a beer with everybody. So he's sort of saying, I'm out here for everybody. You know, obviously, the first week, he's not going to get to everybody. But I think eventually he'll have to see if his charm offensive works.
Russ, anything we should be looking forward to historically?
Big picture, if you look at the history of the University of South Carolina, it is replete with governors and legislators involving themselves, intruding, if that's a better term, trying to influence throughout its history.
Saul Blatt with President Smith back in the right after World War II.
Thomas Cooper.
An old admiral.
Cooper, one of the most well-known presidents in the university's history. The legislature was on him the entire time because of his religious beliefs, finally got him to resign. In 1850, or in the late 1800s, Ben Tillman wanted to do away with the University of South Carolina. He ultimately restructured it. Following the Brown desegregation decision in 1954, the dean of the College of Education at USC was very outspoken on how the state needs to deal with this in a forthright way and, you know, no trouble. He was fired. Pressure came. So the horseshoe is a block from the State House.
Yeah, proximity doesn't do it any favors.
While this is unprecedented, I think, especially with the governor's involvement and the Fisher and the board, it's not the first time that the University of South Carolina, as the first and the flagship university, has had to deal with things coming from across the street.
Well, the era of USC President Bob Caslin starts August 1st, and you know Andy Shane with the Post and Courier and Russ McKinney and South Carolina Public Radio will be following along with it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020 related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. Starting off, the Post and Courier reports that Mark Sanford, the former South Carolina governor and congressman, is thinking about challenging President Donald Trump for the Republican nomination. Keyword, thinking. He hasn't formed an exploratory committee, which is one of many reasons his quote-unquote announcement was greeted with skepticism. This according to the Associated Press. He wants issues such as the debt and fiscal restraint to be the focus of the national conversation. Others just see Mark Sanford wanting to be the focus of the conversation. We'll find out more in 30 days, says Sanford. Democrat Congressman Jim Clyburn and Joe Cunningham voted with a majority to condemn President Trump's July 14th tweets, in which he told four Democrat women of color to, quote, go back and fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came, quote. Three of the four women were born in America, and all of them are citizens. Republican Congressmen Joe Wilson, Jeff Duncan, William Timmons, Ralph Norman, and Tom Rice voted against the measure. And Cunningham broke with Clyburn and most Democrats to vote against gradually raising the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $15 per hour starting in 2025. Now, the measure passed, but he told the Post and Courier that $15 may sound good in places like San Fran, but not back home. The Post and Courier reports that Adair Ford Burroughs, a Democratic lawyer and first-time political candidate from Williston, more than doubled Joe Wilson's fundraising in the second quarter of 2019, according to federal financial disclosures. She raised $246,000. Now, Senator Lindsey Graham raised more than $3 million over the past 3 months and has a $6.5 million re-election war chest. And Nikki Haley, the former South Carolina governor and U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, was named the 9th most admired woman in the world, according to market research group YouGov. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here with some more state trivia? He is. Russ, welcome back.
Thank you.
What you got for us?
How hot is it? We've talked about weather-related things for the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. So after this week, and as hot as it's been all across the state, maybe we ought to stick with that big high-pressure dome. We talked last week about the Bermuda High stalling and can lead to hot, dry conditions in the state. The hottest recorded temperature in South Carolina is 113 degrees.
Oh, my God. Was that yesterday? Was that this weekend?
That is hot. But our question is, where was that high temperature recorded?
I was just going to ask you that. Okay.
113 degrees. So, A, Columbia, of course.
Famously hot.
Famously hot. B, Aiken. C, Camden. D, Lake City.
Well, I mean, I feel like when we say famously hot, I mean, that's going to be probably the play I'm going to go with is just because it's so hot here. You get that name for a reason. I want to say maybe that's because of the this record that you're saying. So what were they again, Russ? You said Columbia?
Columbia, Aiken, mm-hmm. Camden, Lake mm-hmm. City.
Some horse country and then the PD. Yeah, I mean, Aiken, you can think it's down there. It's very inland, too. I just have to go with Columbia for famously hot. I feel like Lake City is going to get a little bit of a breeze more. Like, when I lived in Florence, it never seemed... It was hot, but it wasn't, like, Columbia hot. Mm-hmm. And here I am in Columbia, and I can say, yes, it is famously hot.
Well, those hottest temperatures recorded over time are going to be on the so-called Sand Belt, mm-hmm. which runs from, say, Aiken to Lexington to Columbia to Camden to Florence and on into the PD and on into North Carolina rather. So you can count that. You can kind of figure it's going to be one of those spots.
There we go.
Mm-hmm. But the correct answer is A, Columbia.
Here we go. Famously hot.
June 29th in 2012.
Oh my gosh.
The National Weather Service recorded 113 degrees.
At the airport.
Actually at USC at a substation at USC. So things are hot over there. All summer.
Yeah, they're always hot over there at USC. Well, aren't they? That's a good tie-in there.
But also in the summer of 2012, Camden recorded a high of 112 degrees. So again, on that sand belt.
Uh-huh.
But, and it just validates that old saying, you know, the only thing that stands between Columbia and hell is a screen door.
Thank you, Russ.
Okay.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, like Friends of the Pod DC Reporter, Jay Stysons, and Clueless Cluer. I think I said that right, Clueless. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. It's really sticky. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Sean Scott is our intern. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on July 22, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening. Secret message. Cats is anti-dog propaganda. There's nothing in a rule book that says a dog can't play basketball!
Air Bud. It's an Air Bud reference.